All right, let's start. Yeah, so I noticed that I went a bit fast on Tuesday. So today, let me talk a little bit more about band theory, just hopefully to get you more comfortable with some of the basic notions here. So this is the outline for today. So I'll give some general comments on, you know, these three notions, insulator, metal, and semi-metal, that are actually more widely applicable for many-body quantum physics in general. And then I'll talk about just some concepts of stability and instabilities of these phases of matter, right? How robust are their behavior, essentially? Okay. Part of that will be on density wave and essentially how you break lattice translation symmetry, how you go from a metal to an insulator. And then I'll also revisit the graphene, which we talked about on Tuesday, and you also did it on your own on the Tuesday tutorial. So hopefully you have a better idea what that thing is. But it won't be a repetition of what I did on Tuesday. It's going to be a different viewpoint. Okay. All right, so let me start with some general comments. So if I think about quantum phases of matter, right, meaning many-body quantum systems at some reasonably low temperature, right? Because usually we like to go to temperatures below some characteristic scale to get some interesting universal physics. Also, we want to go to long distance, you know, so that things are. Anyway, so there are infinitely many such different phases like that. So how do we think about them? Well, there is an organizing principle. It's a very crude classification of phases of matter. Again, as I said, at some low, reasonably low temperature. Okay. This classification is according to essentially how many stuff are left at low temperature, essentially. So it's meaning according to how many degrees of freedom are still available for me to excite at such low temperature. So how many excitations there are, or if you like, degree of freedom. So the question of how many excitations are there essentially have three answers. The first answer is nothing. And this is also known, I mean, it has many names. It's also known as insulator. The more general notion is to say that the system is gapped. As you've seen, an insulator means some band structure like this in the free fermion case. But the notion of gap is more general. But in the free fermion case, it means you have a filled band. There's an empty band. This is your energy. And then there's a gap. Let me call it delta, larger than zero in between. Right. So if I go to a temperature much less than the gap, then essentially the system is dead. If I want to excite something, well, the minimum thing I can do is to take a particle here and put it here. That costs me energy delta, right? So if I'm at below, and if I'm at temperature much below delta, that, for example, in the Boltzmann weight, that comes with something like this, which is really small. Okay. So for example, if you calculate specific heat, right, which is defined well roughly as dE dt, that thing goes as at low enough temperature goes as this, which is essentially zero. I mean, it's very small. Just put it that way. You can be more precise and say you define a notion of density of state. Okay. So this is the definition is essentially the number of excited states or a number of states with excitation energy. Between E and E plus D. And then you divide that number by D. Okay, depending on your purpose, sometimes we also divide by volume, because this number is going to be proportional to volume. Okay, so this is, yes?
Question, does the gap need to be at the same k?
No. Great question, yeah. This also counts.
And
yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
If I have two gap that is, like, I have disjoint ones,
yeah.
For every k, there is a gap with the
yes.
event, but there could be, like, different k that I have no...
You're asking about this.
Yeah.
Yeah, this one doesn't count, because what happens is if your Fermi energy is here, that's a metal. Yeah, so I'm talking about the simplest case where it's an insulator. because this case is just saying you do have low energy excitation, but that excitation carries some momentum. While in this case, you don't have any low energy excitation. So defined this way, then it's zero as long as E is below delta. Because, well, that's simply saying there's no state. So that's life of insulator. There's basically no life. Well, it turns out that's not true. Turns out there are a huge class of phases of matter that are insulating their gap, so they're pretty much dead at low temperature, but not completely dead. They have, you know, a tiny little bit of interesting stuff left. And that's already an entire field in condensed matter physics known as topological phases of matter. So that on its own is already interesting. Okay? But let's not do that today. Now, okay, there's nothing. Then the other answer is there could be lots of things. By that, I mean metal. Okay, why do I say there's lots of things? Well, think about a two-dimensional Fermi surface. Okay. This is your Brillouin zone, and let's say this is your Fermi surface. Now you ask that same question. Below, at some low energy, let's say energy much below the Fermi energy, for example, how many excitations do I have? Do I have access to? Well, now it's very different, because now I can, for example, take a particle here and move it just a little bit out, and then it goes out of the Fermi sea. Okay? The energy cost of such process can be arbitrarily low. If I'm on a finite system size, then the energy cost is of order 1 over L. Because momentum difference is order 1 over L. So if I'm in the thermodynamic limit, meaning L goes to infinity, then this gap vanishes. Yes?
So in the first example, when you say there are no states that E is less than delta,
yes.
Are there not states in the lower bands?
Oh, no. Look at the lower bands are filled. So if I want to create some excitation, right. So ground state has some energy. Right. So now I want some excited state, let's say, with energy. What can you do? There are two things you can do. You can either remove a particle from the field band. That costs you energy, actually, because it's a negative energy. This thing is negative. So if you are not feeling it, you're getting penalized in terms of energy. You're paying energy. And likewise, you can put a particle here. That costs you energy as well. So the minimal energy you have to get is okay. If you want a bit more precise, if you put your mu here, the minimal energy is the minimal of the difference between these two. Yes?
So I still don't get how do we get these bands?
Sorry?
I still don't get how do we get these bands?
You mean like this from
yeah.
from the lattice?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how do we get them. I don't know.
Oh yeah. So one thing, if you remember the almost free space example, right? So there, let's say, okay, so it's originally it was a parabolic band. Then I turn on the lattice potential, it becomes something like this, right? Remember. Let's say this is your pi over a, this is your minus pi over a, and then there's this thing, it goes on. Remember this figure, right? Did my drawing. And then remember, now k is only defined mod 2 pi over a. So I can move this by minus 2 pi over a, shuffle it to here. Likewise, this piece to here. And then it becomes this. Right. And now if I look, for example, around here, remember this momentum is really the same as this momentum. Think of this as a circle. So if I'm measuring around here, it basically looks like this. That's the simplest model, but of course you can have more complicated models. All right, so so metal. It's gapless, but it's actually more than just being gapless. It has a lot of possible different excitations you can make. For example, you can choose this one, move it a little bit out. You can choose this one, move it out. Essentially, you have infinitely many different choices, right? And that's characterized, again, by the density of state, defined this way. And in the tutorial today, I think you'll see how to actually calculate this for example, for a Fermi surface or for some other system. And then if you calculate that, what you will see is that at low energy, let's say the energy is low, this is a non-zero constant, non-zero, larger than zero, plus order E correction. So as E goes to zero, no matter how small your energy goes to, this thing doesn't vanish. It's a constant. Yes?
By E equals zero, you mean the Fermi energy?
Yes, the excitation energy. I always measure things from the ground state.
The shaded portion is the lower band, right?
Sorry, what?
The shaded portion in the...
This means if I plot it in this 1D cut, it means it's the same band, but only these are below my Fermi, chemical potential or Fermi energy. Yeah, so I can have excitation like moving from one particle from here to here. For example. Yeah, let me draw it more clearly. So I have particle moving from this to this. Okay. So that's for example, this means that if you now measure the specific heat defined this way, you see that it's proportional to temperature. So it's a very different behavior, qualitatively different. Okay. So that's what we call a lot of things. Now there's the third possibility. Well, what's the answer besides nothing and lots of things? Well, it's something. Wow. Sometimes we call it, it has other names. For example, semi-metal. The graphene example you've seen on Tuesday, that belongs to this class. Sometimes this kind of thing also appears in quantum phase transitions. That's an extremely interesting subject on its own. Which I'm not going to cover in this course. Okay. So what does it look like? Well, recall your graphene example that day. So the dispersion looks like this. Now, if I go to low energy, I get some excitation. It's not like an insulator. So of course, let's say my chemical potential is here, so I feel everything below and leave everything above empty. Now I can make a low energy excitation by taking an electron here and, for example, to here. Right? Again, I have a gap that's vanishing. That's 1 over L. Okay, so there's no gap. But what's different from the Fermi surface case is that I can only do that at two special momentum points. Unlike for the Fermi surface, I can do it over the entire surface. Okay. So now, if you calculate, for example, the density of state, which you also do this afternoon, you realize that it's not zero, but it's also not a constant. It goes as it's proportional to E. E is positive, by the way. Okay. Plus higher order correction, of course. Square, blah, blah, blah. So it's not zero. Sorry, it is zero. It is vanishing, but not. It's not only vanishing as a power law. Okay. So there's no constant piece. But only power law. And likewise, if you calculate the specific heat, you realize that it goes as T squared. Okay? So nothing specifically, you get that exponential suppression. A lot of things, you get linear T specific heat. Something, you get T squared. In some other cases, you get some different power. Okay? That's roughly the three kinds of quantum phases condensed matter people spend a lot of time thinking about. Each one is of their own category and has tools that are applicable or powerful. So, but within band theory, you see all three of them already. Okay. So now, let me move on and ask the following question: how robust are these things? For example, I can cook up some toy model, some, let's say, nearest neighbor type binding model, or solve it, and conclude that I get either an insulator, or a metal, or a semi-metal. Then you should ask, to what extent should you believe me? Right. So meaning, suppose I made an error in my modeling. How much does that matter? Okay. The first case, if it's an insulating, if it's gapped, with a gap, let's call delta larger than zero. Then you say, if I have some error in my model, or simply in the way I solve it, let's say I made some approximation, okay, that gives me some error. What's harmful about it? Well, you get a different delta, right? You probably estimate the gap wrong a little bit. So suppose the error is not too big, right? But so what? It's still gap. It's still non-zero. You're not going to suddenly go from one to zero. You go from one to, I don't know, 0.8, right? But as long as I'm at temperature below this new number, those behaviors are still there. Nothing's going to change. So it's so gap phases are generally quite robust. Usually, many of the statements you make on gap phases are pretty safe. Usually, there are exceptions, but that's the focal. Okay. Now let's look at metal. And suppose I also have some error either in the model or in the way I solve the problem. What could happen? Okay. Let me say that. If I have interacting fermions, not free fermions, this problem is extremely interesting. And a large part of the remaining of the course will be on that problem. But for today, let me focus on free fermions. So we're still within band theory. So let's say I draw my favorite Fermi surface again. And let's say if I made some error, what could happen? Right? Well, you say, so if the error doesn't involve translation symmetry breaking, so if translation symmetry is preserved, here, remember, translation symmetry meaning the lattice translation. I'm only moving in discrete lattice units. Then the notion of Brillouin zone is still there. Notion of Fermi surface, well, what could happen? Well, at best, at worst, I change, you know, I got the shape of the Fermi surface wrong. Right? If I'm making only a little bit mistake, what could this change? Well, it could change to something like this. But it's not going to suddenly disappear. Right? So this feature that, you know, I have a constant density of state, my specific heat is going to be linear in T, they're not going to change. Of course, what could change is, for example, the coefficient of this linear T behavior. That could change, right? But most of the other things won't. But that's provided if I preserve translation symmetry. Yes?
Could you just clarify how that argument made use of translation symmetry?
Yeah, that's because I can still talk about the Brillouin zone, but actually, I'll show you right now how breaking translation will ruin this argument. Okay. So let's talk about an example of translation breaking, also known as density wave.
I forgot my step back. So what was the Fermi surface again?
Sorry?
Can you remind me what's the Fermi surface again?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, for that you don't, okay. So let's not worry about Brillouin zone and so on. Let's just think about free space.
Uh-huh.
Right, in free space, the Hamiltonian is P squared over 2m, right? So, and let's say, let me put in a chemical potential minus mu, right? The rule is that the fermion occupation number, so now states are labeled by P, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The fermion occupation number, which is, if you like, this thing, at zero temperature, the rule is it's one if this P squared over 2m minus mu is smaller than zero. Zero if this thing is larger than zero. Now you plot, you think about what this means. It means in the momentum space, there's a circle, right, with radius. Well, the turning point is when it's called the Fermi momentum, you know, if you like, is this. Okay? So there is a circle with radius PF, or a ball in general dimension, within which all the states are occupied, but you know, beyond which it's all empty. Right. So I mean, at finite temperature, you can that gets a little bit correction from the Boltzmann weight and so on. So this sharp turn gets smoothened a little bit, but roughly this picture remains. Okay, as long as your temperature is well below the Fermi energy. This chemical potential, right? So now you can, if you want an excitation, you can take one, for example, within the Fermi surface and then pull it out. That costs very little energy.
But why do you consider 2D?
Oh, no. This thing works in general dimension. Yeah, it's just easier to draw in 2D. If you like, 11 dimension works just perfectly fine. Well, yeah, okay, yeah, let me not say more about that. Okay, so right. So now let's look at an example. So let's look at the simplest possible example, 1D. So let's go back to the type binding model we talked about on Monday. So I have a chain of atoms, if you like, with one fermion orbit per site, so they're hopping. So the atomic site I label as with an integer I, or I hat, if you like. Okay, so remember the original time binding model we solved was something like a nearest hopping model, one plus the Hermitian conjugate. Remember this one we solved, and this was basically give you 2t k cosine k c dagger k c k. Right. So the dispersion looks like this.
This is
pi over it. A, or just pi, let's call it a. Remember that. So now let me add another thing to this. And by the way, this one I'm taking chemical potential to be zero. So at in the ground state, what happens is I fill all the energy levels below zero and leave everything above empty. So I get essentially a field Fermi C for half of the Brillouin zone. And you see this is a metal, because I have no problem exciting with very little energy from here to here. Yes?
I don't understand like the argument to have empty and non-empty sites.
Okay. The argument is easiest in ground state. In ground state, the statement is, what is the expectation of this? The expectation of this is just, now I'm writing in this basis, the expectation of H is really just k cosine k, this. Right. Now you ask the question, how can I make it this number as small as possible? Let's say t is greater than zero, for example. Okay. So for that, you say whenever this number, this 2t times cosine k is negative, I make this 1. And by the way, sorry, you remember, because these are fermions, this is always true. So it's either empty or filled, or it can be a superposition, doesn't matter. But at most, it can be 1. So if this number is negative, you want to make this number as big as possible, which is 1. If this number ends up being negative, which is what happens here, then you want this number to be as small as possible, in this case, 0. So that's how you minimize the energy. Yeah. Of course, if you are at finite temperature, you weight that with the Boltzmann weight. But then turns out what will happen is if the level has energy C, that's the C over T plus 1. That's the Fermi distribution function. You can check that as T goes to 0, this goes to the step function. Okay, so So it's a metal to begin with. Now let's introduce some translation symmetry breaking. Okay. How do I do that? Well, one thing the easiest thing one can imagine doing is, for example, on all the odd integer sites, I introduce a positive potential. And on all the even integer sites, I introduce a negative potential. Okay. So in Hamiltonian, what that means, I introduce a term, let me call the coefficient delta, sum over I. Let's call this j. This I goes from, for example, 1 to n. N is the total number of sites. Let's say n is even. And j goes from, for example, 1 to n over 2. Okay, so this term looks like c2j dagger c2j minus c2j plus 1 c2j plus 1. So now even and odd sides are no longer equivalent, right? Because of this minus sign. Okay, and it turns out you will be doing this also in tutorial. But the idea is now you ask, I do the Fourier transform again on this term. Right? So essentially, Bloch theorem tells us whenever we want to solve a band structure, we just do Fourier transform and then see what. That should help you a lot in terms of diagonizing the Hamiltonian. So you do this. So I won't do it here for you. I think you will see some of this later. What you find is that this becomes this, sum over k. Remember, k goes from minus pi to pi, right? So sum over k, again, from minus pi to pi, c dagger k plus pi ck. So now here's a feature. This term, whenever you have a ck, it always comes with a ck dagger. The k doesn't change. That's just saying the momentum is conserved. You take a fermion at an momentum k, it returns back a momentum k. Okay. This one doesn't. You take a momentum you take a fermion at momentum k, it returns you one at momentum k plus pi. So momentum is no longer conserved. It's conserved only up to pi, which is not surprising because this thing has the wrong period. It's a plus one on the odd integer, minus one on even integer, so it has momentum pi. So this potential actually gives you a scattering at momentum pi. Right? Because you know this function, if you like, it's a function that looks like this. So this should make it more obvious. E to the I pi times I integer. Right. So when I is odd, this gives you minus one. When I is even, this gives you plus one. Right. So that's, and this thing changes momentum by pi. That's how it works. Yes.
Going back a bit, I'm actually not sure what you mean by the fermion operators in brackets. Is that like a?
Oh, sorry. This is the expectation value. Take your ground state.
Over the ground state.
Yeah. Sorry. This is similarly, you can take the thermal expectation value at zero temperature. It's the same thing. All right. So what does it do? Well, okay. So you'll solve the full thing, hopefully, in tutorial. But let me just suppose an easy regime. Suppose delta is much smaller than t. Or let me call this width, which is, 4t here, because cosine runs from minus 1 to 1. Let me define this as w. It's sometimes called the bandwidth. So if delta is much smaller than the bandwidth, you can do perturbation theory, mostly, right? Because let's say if you're considering a level here, this pi momentum scattering will take you from here to here. But again, these two states have a large difference in energy. So that perturbation does very little for you. Right? So you can do non-degenerate perturbation theory. Usually, non-degenerate perturbation theory at first order doesn't do much. Right? It changes your energy level a little bit. Otherwise, it's boring. The only time you cannot do non-degenerate perturbation is when the two levels, they differ by momentum pi, but they are also at the same energy. That's exactly here. Okay. So what will happen if I focus on states near these two momentum, it's going to be exactly the same problem as the almost free space problem I showed you on Monday. So what will happen is that the energy level becomes this. Originally, it just goes up, but now it's like this. This is at pi over 2 minus pi over 2. So this is original pi. Now this probably looks familiar. It looks really similar to what you've seen on Monday with the almost free space problem, right? The only difference is it doesn't go on forever. It terminates here.
Why doesn't it go on forever?
Yeah, because I start with a system with finite Hilbert space dimension per volume, right? The almost free one, to begin with, I have a totally parabolic band, so the momentum can go forever. This one, even before I turn on this perturbation, the momentum is only defined from minus pi to pi. Yes.
In the free one, we had a problem with, we had the same momentum at the boundaries of our zone.
Yeah.
But now we have it like the half boundary of our zone. So why do we have a similar problem?
Sorry, maybe I didn't get your question. Can you repeat?
So last time we had like minus pi over a.
Yes.
Right, and here our actual boundary is just pi. So why do we have a problem at minus pi over 2?
Oh yeah, no. So the thing is, this scattering scatters momentum at pi. Last time the unit was chosen, that unit was 2 pi over a.
Okay.
This time the scatterer is at pi. So that scatters the momentum, say, from minus pi over 2 to plus pi over 2.
Okay.
Because this is the only pair that satisfies A, they differ by momentum pi, and B, before you turn on the perturbation, their energy are the same. Yeah. Yes.
So in this picture, that's the wave picture. We still have this green zone picture, right?
I'm going to come to that.
Awesome.
By scattering at
moment. Yeah, it's just a simple way to say this Hamiltonian. For example, if you act on a state, it takes you from k to k plus pi.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's basically what scattering is. Or the better phrase is probably to say the Hamiltonian, now you have a matrix element between states of momentum pi and k and k plus pi. So the off-diagonal matrix element is the more proper. But I'll be using that phrase.
Would you say that is like non-conservation of momentum?
Yes, by pi.
But like, isn't there a concept of like crystal momentum, which like you take k, you increase it by g.
Yeah.
Pi is k, you get back k.
Yeah, I'll do that very soon. That's the next thing. So you say, okay, now what's the better way to do it? Well, remember when we did the almost free electron, I mean almost free space, we got some picture like this, and then we folded everything to a single Brillouin zone. Right. Here we should do the same. The reason is because now the original translation is broken. So we shouldn't really talk about momentum in the original Brillouin zone. It doesn't exist. However, this breaking of lattice translation is a pretty mild one. It doesn't completely break it. You're now translating by one unit cell is no longer a symmetry, but you can translate by two unit cells. That's still a symmetry. Right? Even goes to even, odd goes to odd. So now, well, if you like to be formal, that just means that your translation symmetry is broken from z to 2z. But if you don't like that language, it doesn't matter. Okay? So now your new unit cell, before the unit cell is just one unit cell, is just one lattice site. Now the new unit cell contains two sites. Right, remember you have positive, negative. So they're not equivalent. And now you also have a new reciprocal lattice vector. And in one dimension, recall that this is simply, let me call it g tilde. I mean, tilde means it's now new. It's the two, so by the way, new unit cell means that your lattice constant is now twice the original one. Okay. Which means your new reciprocal lattice vector should be 2 pi over the new lattice constant. And then that's pi over a. But here, let's call A 1. that's what I've been implicitly doing here. That just means my g hat is pi, which also means my momentum is really only defined up to pi. So I should only talk about momentum within, let's say, minus pi over 2 to plus pi over 2. Everything above is like redundant. So now, again, I move this part to here, move this part to here. But what does that mean? Well, remember, previously we have you know, all the negative energy modes filled, but it's still gapless. I can excite a level from here to here, no problem. But now I have everything here filled because they're at negative energy, everything here empty. But now if I try to excite something, I have to take an electron from here to here. But that costs me an energy. Let me call this delta. So even a small perturbation actually cost a qualitative change of behavior. Right? Previously it's a metal, now it's an insulator. Okay? So the lesson is, so that you see that even if I go to two dimension, similar things will happen. It's not necessarily as drastic as that one, where you suddenly kill everything that's gapless. Here you get, you know, if you break translation symmetry, you induce some scattering, very much like that one, maybe on the Fermi surface from one side to the other. So you may kill some part of the Fermi surface if it's small. Yes.
I'm just wondering if I understand correctly. So you're saying that we're perturbing our original lattice slightly, but it seems to me like if you're flipping all the every other site, it seems like it's not that small of a perturbation.
Sorry, what?
Like so what do you mean when you say like the perturbation's small? Like you're saying through a small perturbation.
W is the width, it's of order t. Right? So originally I have some lattice, they're some nearest neighbor type binding model, they're happy. Now I just perturb it by this term.
Okay.
Add a small term like this. Right? The thing is, it's small, but then the question is, does it do anything qualitative?
Yeah.
Right. For an insulator, it's gonna do something like this, which is not very important. But for a metal, it gives you a qualitative change. It opens a gap for you. And the gap is small. That you can calculate. The gap is of the same order as delta. So the gap is small. But it's going from zero to a non-zero number. So it doesn't matter how small this is. This is infinitely larger than zero. Right. So.
How do you find the gap, by the way? Like,
sorry?
How do you actually, like, can you like just outline the calculation?
Oh. Yeah, for example, two things. You can actually try to solve this Hamiltonian. Right? It's no longer diagonal in K, but now you can group K and K plus pi into a two-dimensional vector and solve that two by two matrix. It's again diagonizing a two by two matrix. I think you would do something like that in the tutorial. Yeah, you will. Also, you can just do perturbation theory, if this is true. So what I said there, diagonizing two by two matrix, that's true. No, whether delta is smaller or larger than t. If delta is much smaller than t, you can do perturbation theory. It's a degenerate perturbation theory. So it's the same perturbation theory. So again, diagonizing a simple 2x2 matrix, pretty much the same one I showed you on Monday for the almost free. Yes?
Is it hard to see this kind of thing in experiments?
This is a pretty famous thing. It's called the Su-Schreifer-Higgers chain. So I mean, density waves are induced routinely in experiment. Sometimes not as simple as this one, but yes.
When you like erased the outer part and then you put them in the middle,
yes.
You don't really know. Like,
yeah. So the thing is this one. So I should really treat a momentum k and k plus pi to be the same momentum. So if I'm here, I can, let's say, minus all the momentum by pi. It's not physically doing anything. It's just relabeling. Yeah. So if I minus everything by pi, this entire thing shifts here. Likewise here, shifts here.
This is interesting. You just doubled your lattices.
Yeah.
Two sublattices.
Yeah. So essentially you have two sublattices in each unit cell. So you expect two bands. So you expect the number of bands to have doubled.
Can you just say it again why at those two points I could not do degenerate perturbation theory?
Yeah, so if you do non-degenerate perturbation, remember in non-degenerate perturbation there's this factor. You take from state one to state two,
mm-hmm.
for example, you look at the wave function. Now this is zero.
At those points?
Yeah.
So I have to go to degenerate perturbation.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So one can think of these processes as before we had like a Bravais lattice without any base at each point, and now we have a Bravais lattice which has double lattice.
Yes.
But now we have a base inspector.
Yes.
Point.
Yes.
Yeah. Is the wave here?
Sorry?
Why is it called the density wave, or what exactly is the wave?
I mean, this thing looks like a wave, right? Whenever I have, let's say, some q times I. Remember, I is more or less x, right? So it's like a wave,
okay.
Except the q is at pi.
Physically, what would be like a charge density wave in a wave system?
Oh yeah, this will be more like a charge density wave. I'm talking about spinless fermion again. But spin density wave will do very similar thing.
That exponential your delta? Or where are you putting the exponential of e to the I pi I hat?
Oh no. Remember it's one on
just in there.
Even and minus one on odd.
Okay.
That's what a e to the I pi n will do.
That's great.
So you said that the behavior of the system changed significantly with the small perturbation.
Yes.
So it went from being a metal to
insulator.
Okay, but you said it's like a very small gap.
Yes.
So this is like even just an infinitesimal gap.
Sort of an order of limit thing. Even if the gap is small, you are still allowed to think about temperature well below that gap. If the gap is zero, you can't do that. Right. So even if I have only a small gap, now if my temperature is well above that gap, then I don't see it. It makes no difference whatsoever. Right. But if I'm now have temperature much smaller than this one, then it goes to that exponential suppression regime. Right. For gapless system, I can't do that. That regime doesn't exist. So. Yeah, if you remember your STEMAC course, this kind of thing is called essentially relevant perturbation. No, okay, let me not confuse you. Forget about it. All right, let's take a 5-minute break.
We do that in STEMAC.
I thought you guys did some STEMAC, some RG in STEMAC.
No.
We didn't even have a homework on KD.
No. Yeah, no. The
between
us, I remember that we have like the for example in the random walk parameterization, the sigma zero was relevant, but like all the higher moments of the random walk are not relevant. The random walk, is that what you mean?
Yes.
Okay.
But so that wait, that's the only example you've done on RG?
That's the only example.
No, we did a whole bunch of
spin stuff.
Okay, so
stuff is going to the random walk. Yeah, but the spins are random walks.
Oh, okay. Okay. So,
yeah, but
okay. All right. Good for me to know that. I won't assume you know RG anymore. So, okay. So that's for metal. Now let's talk about semi-metal. Let me just go back to graphene. Okay. I assume by now you know what I mean by this figure. But if you don't, just still ask. Yes.
Because this was a 1D example. What happens in 2D?
Yeah. Okay. I meant to say that, but I was going slower then. But okay. Let me say that. In higher dimension, it's a little bit more complicated. It's if you break translation symmetry a little bit, it does something. It's not harmless, but it doesn't do as drastically as that. So let me show you an example. So I won't actually solve the Hamiltonian for you. You're welcome to solve it yourself because it's not that hard anyway. So essentially, the square lattice version of that. Let's say I have nearest neighbor hopping. Actually, for this purpose, I want a little bit of second neighbor hopping. I mean, it makes your type binding a little bit more complicated, but still you can solve it. So now you suppose I also add this kind of density wave, meaning it's positive, slightly positive here, slightly negative here, slightly negative here, slightly positive here. Right. So it's like sometimes it's called a pi-pi density wave. Because in x direction, it's like a momentum pi density wave, just like that, right? Because it's alternating between even and odd, and likewise in y direction. So in both directions, it has momentum pi. Right? So what that will do is to scatter your walk state from k to k plus pi pi. Okay. And suppose it's weak. You can ask, what does that do? Well, if you solve for the original band structure, so let's say if delta is 0, right, before you turn on that perturbation, what does it look like? Well, OK, this is your Brillouin zone. This is kx. This is ky. Let's say pi minus pi, minus pi minus pi, pi minus pi. You get the idea. Right. The Fermi surface. Okay. First of all, let me say that again. You are at half filling. So at each site, the Fermi occupation number is 1/2. Okay. So then you get a Fermi surface. It roughly looks like this. Let me. So everything here is filled within this surface. This is a closed surface, even though it looks like open. But remember, this point is same as this point. This point is same as this point, and likewise. So everything white, the white part are, okay, that's the original Fermi surface. Now you add this perturbation, delta much smaller than w. Well, the same logic applies. It's not going to do much unless it scatters two states that differ by momentum pi pi and happen to have the same energy before you turn on the perturbation. Right? The exactly the same logic. Then what you see is this. So I'm drawing a lattice, connecting the four midpoints here. The special thing about this is that these two sides differ by pi pi, and likewise, these two sides differ by some pi pi. Sorry, these two, yeah, it's pi pi, and this is also pi pi. So what will happen is that all the other states don't get changed too much, except things near here. Because these are the regions, for example, these two are connected by momentum pi pi, and they happen to have the same energy before you turn on the perturbation. So what will happen is that it becomes something in analog with, erase it. If you remember, for the 1D case, you went from this to this. So the analog of that in 2D is you went from that to, yeah, I need to draw this carefully. This. Everything here filled. So where does this weird shape come from? If you remember, before you turn on the perturbation, this one is connected with this one. And then, you know, this one connected this one, then you get this nice shape. But because of that perturbation, that singular perturbation at this momentum, you open up a gap here. Also, because you've broken translation symmetry, now you have to double your unit cell, right? The new Brillouin zone, same logic as that there. There it went from minus pi to pi to minus pi over 2 to pi over 2. If you go through the argument, you see that this inner square is your new Brillouin zone. So now you should only talk about momentum within this small square. Of course, what about the outer ones? Well, the outer ones, you can always move them by some pi, because that's new, your new reciprocal lattice vector. And now form this thing. And then you see that what this looks like is that now you have two bands. But the first band looks like this, where everything, it's mostly filled, but then you have this this semicircles within with which they are empty. Again, these are closed surface because this point is identified with this point. So it's actually closed. Okay. It's a torus, if you like. That's the inner one. The outer one, now if you play the trick of moving everything by pi, it takes a little bit of drawing. But if you do it, you find that it looks like this. Again, this is a closed surface because of periodicity. Okay. So essentially what you get is you get from a metal with a large Fermi surface to two bands, each one with a pretty small Fermi surface. Right? This one is like a small hole pocket. This one is like a small particle pocket. So that's for weak delta. Now if you crank up your delta, or even larger, even much larger, what happens is that you see that this pocket gets shrinking. This pocket also get shrinking. And then if this is really large, delta is really much larger, what you see is a lower band that's completely filled, no pockets left, and an upper band that's completely empty. Again, no pocket. But that regime is a trivial regime, because if this happens, you can basically treat the Hamiltonian as mostly this delta term. What does that delta term do? Well, it's a term that says on this side, the energy is negative, so I should fill it. On this side, the energy is very positive, so I should leave it empty. So this regime is an insulator, is an extremely simple insulator, where I have one particle sitting on this such sites on one of the sublattices. Okay? And introducing a little bit of hopping doesn't change much. As I said, if you already established that it's an insulator, introducing a little bit of perturbation won't change that fact. So the lesson is, in higher dimension, if I have a Fermi surface, and now if I introduce some lattice symmetry breaking, it may do something non-trivial. But if the breaking is weak, typically it doesn't do as drastic as in 1D. In 1D, it kills everything immediately. In higher D, it kills things gradually. Okay. But still, it's non-trivial.
So over here, is it fair to say that it's become an insulator now, or what?
Yeah, this one you can call it an insulator. This one is still metallic. Just slightly less metallic than before. The Fermi surface gets smaller.
This is
yeah.
So if you consider further nearest neighbor hopping, would it change things or?
Not really. If it's generic. Being generic is actually important. The thing is, the reason I said you need a second neighbor hopping here is because if it's literally just nearest neighbor hopping, that's actually a very special point, special model. For that model, you turn on a little bit of this delta pi pi density with the entire Fermi surface is gone. Right? But that's not generic. So generically, we expect some second neighbor hopping. So this is the more generic feature. Yes.
I'm just wondering, so when you are drawing the Fermi surface and you're showing these intersection points between like the dotted line and the curves, is this always going to happen, or sometimes could like these dotted lines like miss and not intersect?
Oh yes. For example, if you start with a pretty tiny Fermi surface, let's say this one, then nothing's going to happen.
Okay.
So, same there, right? There, if you let's say I'm not at half filling, I'm at 1/3 filling. Then the fact that there's a gap open at plus minus pi over 2 doesn't concern me, because that's very much away from the Fermi surface. But in terms of dispersion, that will always happen, because in terms of dispersion, this states here get changed. Right? But in terms of low energy observable, then it depends on exactly where is my chemical potential, where is my what is the charge density? Yes.
In that figure. The left one is the lower band, right?
Yes.
So if this figure were to be made in that particular way with the cut, how would we represent it? Like any cut?
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
In the sense, like there should be two bands coming from the two sublattices.
Yes.
There's just a cut, like how will it look like?
Depending on where you cut, because they keep missing each other. So if I cut from here, what I will see is that I think I get like this, and then the upper band is completely filled. Right? If I cut through this line, right? Then I get this part, which is basically this thing. But if I cut, for example, from here, what I see is the lower band appears to be completely filled. But the upper band has some particle pocket here. So imagine this line is my chemical potential. Okay. Any more question? Now I will continue. So that's for metal. Oh yes.
In your lattice, you have arrows and you have like dots. Are those actually different, or are you just trying?
Sorry. What?
The 2D lattice.
The waves.
This one.
Yeah.
It's a positive potential.
Okay.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Sorry. I meant a positive potential.
Okay.
This I meant a negative potential.
Okay.
I feel like these are like C. Ci dagger ci minus cj dagger cj if I is in this sublattice and j is in this sublattice. Sorry. All right. Okay, so that's what happens with metal if you try to break some symmetry and destabilize it. Now let's go back to an example of semi-metal, which is graphene. By now, you probably have a better idea on what this thing is. So let me ask play the same, more or less the same game, right? And ask, okay, so I solved, and or you have solved, the nearest neighbor time-binding graphene model. You get a dispersion that roughly look like this, right? It's a Dirac fermion. Again, with a bandwidth W of order T, right? Now suppose, now on top of the stupid nearest neighbor time binding model, you add another Hamiltonian. another perturbation. Let's say of again with you know with coefficient of order delta. Right? It could be pretty generic. It could be some you know funny hopping from site I to site I prime. You know third neighbor, fifth neighbor. Could be a you know could look funny. So what could happen? Right. So there are two ways to ask this question. Again, if delta is much smaller than W, then you ask what could happen. Well, okay, let me now assume that delta H preserves translation symmetry. I mean, you can certainly consider things that break translation, but let me not do it here. Yes?
And what about rotation? We talk about translation.
Yeah, rotation, I'll come back. It's going to be very important. So, but bottom line is if you break rotation, you ruin the Dirac fermion if you don't. So assume this preserved translation, which means that it's going to become something that's diagonal in K. That's what preserving translation means in momentum space. Okay, take a K, returns to a K. But as you've seen, it's in general you get a 2x2 matrix here because of the sublattice structure. Okay, 2x2. That in general depends on K. Okay, but the amplitude is of order delta. So you can ask, well, what could it happen? Well, since this perturbation only takes K to K, it doesn't do things like that. It doesn't take your stay here and scatter here. It doesn't do that. At best, it takes a stay here and scatter to the state with the same momentum. Okay. That's the only thing it can do. But if I've assumed that delta is much smaller than the bandwidth, this kind of thing is not going to do anything. Right? I can scatter here. It's all going to be suppressed. Right? Plus, it's you know, it changes something very quantitative. Of order t over, sorry, delta over t. Except near here, right? Because here, the two bands, we say they touch, right? These are momentum points at which the Bloch state at the two bands are, you know, more or less have the same energy. Again, this is the regime you're not supposed to use non-degenerate perturbation theory. Okay? But this is also a relatively simple regime, because near this regime, as you've seen, the dispersion is linear. You can almost treat it as a Dirac fermion. And then you can ask, if I would start from a Dirac fermion, add a perturbation of this form, what could it do? In fact, secretly, that's what I've always been doing, except in 1D. Right? Remember the 1D example, we had this parabolic band, and then there's a scattering between these two. Then I say, you know, of momentum 2 pi over a, let's say. Then I say, let's look at fermion point, modes near this momentum, and I expand it. When I expand it, let's say p square becomes something like pi over a plus delta p square. There's a constant from the pi over a square, but then I kept only the term that's like 2 pi over a times delta p. I neglected delta p square, which seems okay if I'm sufficiently close there. But you know, something linear in delta p looks Dirac, actually. Right? So the graphing game is really just a two-dimensional version of that. Okay. So that's more explanation of what I've been doing on Tuesday, but which went pretty fast. I noticed. But the bottom line is interesting things can only happen near the Dirac fermion, the Dirac point. It's only happen near Dirac points, which in this case they are the K and K prime, which is minus K. Let me remind you the Brillouin zone. Is a hexagon. Oh, okay. Let me first remind you the real space lattice is a honeycomb lattice. with a translation operator, translation vector A1 and A2, and sublattice structure A and B. Okay, and this is the Brillouin zone with the reciprocal lattice vector G1, and I think this one is G2. Right. So this point is called K. It's identified with this point because by G2. Wait, this is, sorry, this, I think this is G2, this is my notation. This is K, this is K, this is K prime, which is minus K, this is K prime, this is K prime. Okay, just remind you of the notation, yes.
Yeah, I didn't understand how you created the Brillouin zone. I think that you were like looking at the bisections.
Yes, yes, so that's a trick. I mean, it's not the only way. The Brillouin zone is a matter of choice. Some choices are more convenient than the others. This choice allows you to look at the symmetries more explicitly. So the general trick to do that is essentially take any two G vector, but also with some linear combinations. In this case, you can also look at this, this I think G2, G1, this is G1 plus G2. So now you look at the bisection of this, and then look at the minimum surface formed by this bisection. This is minus G1, you see? So the reason why this construction works is the guarantee is that these two boundaries are related by a G1. Sorry, this is G1, G2. For example, these two boundaries are related by G1. They differ by G1. And by definition, any momentum differed by G1 or any reciprocal lattice vector, the integer combination of them, should be treated as the same momentum. Right. So this guarantees that there's no redundancy. All right, so what I was going to say. Yeah, so interesting things can only happen at the Dirac point. So what could happen? Well, okay, there are four things. First one is absolutely nothing. Well, no, okay. Well, then that's 5-1. So let's forget about the absolutely nothing one. That's unlikely. But then there is the boring one, which is suppose. Now let me only look at one Dirac fermion, because I'm assuming the perturbation preserves translation symmetry. It doesn't take this Dirac fermion to this one. Okay, so just one Dirac fermion is enough. Suppose this is my chemical potential.
I'm sorry, what did you say about translation symmetry, the Dirac fermion?
I won't say much. In fact, if you introduce a translation symmetry that's breaking at a momentum, that's the difference between these two, then you open up the gap. That's a density wave. Yeah, but let me not say that. I mean, yeah, okay, I've already said that. So. yeah, but that's pretty much it. Which is not surprising, because even before I break translation symmetry, I've already have two orbits per unit cell. Right? So now if I further break translation, I have more. Right? So it gets easier and easier to get an insulator. What's non-trivial here is that even though I have two orbits per unit cell here, I don't get an insulator. Right? That's the non-trivial bit. And that turns out to be is guaranteed by other symmetries, other than translation. Okay. So what can happen? Well, the first thing that can happen is this thing gets changed in a boring way. For example, the dispersion gets fattened a little bit. We don't really care. Okay, velocity change. Essentially, that's a velocity change. That's pretty boring. The second thing that could happen, which you will probably show in your homework, is that this thing gets shifted in energy a little bit.
So that's like a Fermi velocity change?
Yeah. So you still have the intersection, the Dirac cone-like structure. Except now it doesn't happen exactly at chemical potential equal to zero. Okay. This will be true, for example, if you add second neighbor hop.
You mean only the second neighbor hop?
Oh, you can add, I don't know, fourth and so on.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So this is, for example, which probably will be part of your homework.
Can you repeat what so the first one was for velocity change, the second one was for what?
The shift in the energy at the Dirac point.
Okay.
Oh, will both the Dirac cones actually shift in the same way?
That depends on your symmetry. Now, if you have some inversion symmetry preserved, yes. Because the inversion symmetry relates K and K prime. So that's the second possibility. The third possibility is that, well, let's say this is your momentum. It went from, it's still a Dirac fermion, except the Dirac fermion gets moved a little bit, right? This becomes this. Yes.
Explain what the Dirac cones mean, like represent again.
Yes. So, meaning near this momentum, if I expand, for example, the dispersion relation, what happens is that E, K, is equal to plus minus some velocity times square root of delta KX squared plus delta KY squared. So, it's a cone like structure.
Yes. Okay.
Right. So what I'm saying here is there could be some prohibition that, you know, does this, for example. It's just an overall shift of energy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry for going back to that. So when you said the translation symmetry is broken, so the band splits, like the gap opens at one of the Dirac cones?
Both. Generically both. If you are at the right momentum, you need the right momentum scatter.
This last one, you're saying that the K points are moving, basically?
Yes. No. I'm not saying the K point by definition is the zone corner. I'm saying the Dirac point is moving away from the K point.
Okay.
Yeah.
But they can only move along the zone boundary, you said last time, right?
No, sorry. I draw it on the zone boundary just for convenience. They don't. Depending on what other symmetries you preserve, they may or may not.
If you move it off of the zone boundary, doesn't that mean that you're creating more Dirac cones?
No. It just means you break some more symmetries.
Okay.
Right. So, essentially, Dirac cone moves away from K, let's say K plus delta K, with some delta K. And last time, I showed you that this is not possible if the perturbation you added preserves the C3 rotation symmetry. What I mean by C3 rotation, the C3 rotation is, for example, take, you do have some choice here, but let's say take this point, rotate by 2 pi over 3. Okay? So that's a symmetry of your problem. If that's a symmetry of your problem, then this K goes to this point. But these two are related by a G vector, so they must be the same. So which means K and K prime, which is minus K, are invariant under C3. So this is a special feature of lattice momentum, right? The continuum momentum doesn't do that. For continuum momentum, if I want a momentum that doesn't change under rotation, it has to be zero. But on lattice, because of the periodicity of the in the definition of momentum, you have some room to wiggle. Right? You can rotate the momentum, it becomes something else, but as long as they only differ by an integer multiple of the reciprocal lattice vector, then you count them as the same. So if you preserve C3, then Dirac point shouldn't move away from the C3 invariant points, which are K and K prime.
So, but the C3 rotation is just like symmetry of the lattice itself, right? Like,
yes.
So this particular case will not occur in this
scenario. No. It all depends on what perturbation you add. You can add a perturbation that explicitly break lattice rotation symmetry. For example, you know, in your original time binding model, you have T, T, T here. Now do this. Make this T prime slightly away from T. That preserves all the symmetries except C3. Right. And then you can actually, you know, play with it for yourself and see that if you do that a little bit, it doesn't kill the Dirac fermion, but it moves the Dirac cone slightly away from those two special momenta. Yes.
Are these deformations relevant?
That depends on your RG scheme. So this one you count as relevant. This one is marginal. This one is marginal. Mass is relevant. In the most common RG scheme. Yeah.
So in three, you're shifting the cone, like the midpoint of the cone?
Yeah. I mean, of course, you can have a combination of different scenarios in the simplest case. And now the last possibility is that you open up a gap. And this, on Tuesday, I have shown you that this is not possible if the perturbation preserves the C2 rotation symmetry and time reversal. Let me remind you, C2 means essentially a pi rotation around this point, or you can choose this point, doesn't really matter. Time reversal, in this simplest case, just means Ci goes to Ci for any fermion operator, but I also have my I goes to minus I. It's anti-unitary.
At which we do these C3 or C2 rotations, that matters, right?
For this argument, it doesn't. They do different things, but they will both do the job of preventing you from having a gap.
Like in general, if you have a general lattice,
yes.
And like there's two points,
yes,
A and B,
yes, yes,
on A, like
yes,
the C3 and C2,
yes, A and yes, yes, yes. So that's why I kept, just for convenience, let's all do this. But you are perfectly allowed to ask what does C3 symmetry around this point, or what does C2 around this point.
And like they'll all have different cases for.
The way they are represented on this Bloch state will be different, turns out. But in terms of preventing a mass gap, they all do the job. So that's why here I'm not distinguishing.
So in the lattice, if there's one point which like preserves C2 and time reversal,
yeah,
but you can expect that there will be no mass gap.
Okay. Yeah, but if you have translation symmetry, if you have one point of C2 inversion, you have infinitely many points.
Right.
Yeah. So just pick anyone. All right. So. You know, maybe the order is wrong, but this is what I have done on Tuesday, in case you didn't realize. And also, the thing is, okay, what you can ask, what if you do the opposite? If you, let's say you introduce, let me take another board. Actually, let me take that one. Yes.
Did you say on Tuesday that when we actually added that mass term, it did not preserve those symmetries?
Yes.
The Dirac cone did not change. So
yes.
Now what we are saying is the opposite of that.
Okay. So okay. Let me do it slowly. So let's take an example. So suppose I have an example of this. Say, I is the unit cell index, and ci a dagger ci a minus ci b dagger ci b. Okay. Anyway, let me draw the lattice again. Remember, A means this sublattice and B means this sublattice. Suppose I add such a term, right? So this breaks inversion symmetry. So the statement here is that from Tuesday is that if I break inversion symmetry, I expect this term to become a mass term in the vicinity of this Dirac fermion, just by symmetry analysis. And then that mass term will give you a mass, we'll do this. We'll get you an insulator. So you can see this explicitly. I think this may even be your homework. But because, I mean, again, you always do a Fourier transform and see what's going on. And this one, the Fourier transform itself is not hard because it's diagonal in space. Right? So if you do a Fourier transform, you get a constant, right? Except, well, essentially you get something. I mean, there may be factors of two or something. Okay, let me put it this way. Delta minus delta, sorry. Remember, these CKs are two component vectors. Okay. You expect this just because on side A, you get plus delta. On side B, you get minus delta. But remember, what was the original term from the nearest neighbor type binding model? Well, that's something like, you know, 1 plus e to the I k dot a2 plus e to the I k dot a2 minus a1, or something like that. Right? You remember roughly the form. Okay. I don't remember the exact signs. But. Now you re-diagonize this Hamiltonian. You see that there is a gap. Because remember before, when you go to near the Dirac fermion, this thing looks like, you know, CK dagger, CK. For example, you go to near the K, right? Then it looks like delta KX sigma X plus delta KY sigma Y. But now what does this look like? Well, this is delta times sigma Z in the Pauli basis. Now this is a 2x2 matrix. Diagonalize it. You see that the energy is plus minus delta kx square plus delta ky square plus delta square. Before, without the delta, this two bands touch at delta k equals 0. But now even at delta k equals 0, you have a gap of 2 delta between your lower and upper band. That's exactly what's happening here. Wait, did I just do the homework for you? Whatever. I mean, but you can see even in real space, why you are supposed to get an insulator. Not rigorous, but suppose you are in the opposite limit. Suppose you are in the limit where delta is much larger than t. Well, again, solve the Hamiltonian for delta first at half filling. What do you expect? Well, you have negative potential here and positive potential here, and you are at half filling, meaning you on average you have half particle per site or one particle per unit cell. What does that mean? Well, that means you fill all the B sites and leave all the A sites empty. That's obviously an insulator. Forgive me for using that word, but that's an insulator. Because literally you're having electrons sitting on all the B sites and the A sites are empty. Now you introduce a little bit of hopping, T. That's a perturbation. But as I said, a perturbation on an insulator doesn't do much. It's still an insulator. So that's the real space way of seeing what's going on. What I didn't show you is that this two regime, so this regime I showed you that it's an insulator by perturbation theory. This regime I showed you is an insulator by the opposite perturbation theory. Well, it turns out that these two are smoothly connected. If you crank up this delta from very small to very large, in between nothing weird is happening, essentially. So of course, this is not always true. Sometimes this is not true, and you know, you get some interesting singular behaviors.
Wait, as soon as you put delta, it just is an insulator.
Yes. And the nature of the insulator is very much the same. It's only a quantitative difference. Yeah, and well, as I said, there is actually a non-perturbative argument in general. You know, you can add very strong perturbation as long as it preserves all the symmetry C2 time reversal C3. You actually don't have you're actually always guaranteed that the two bands will touch at K and K prime. But in fact, the argument is quite elegant. I liked it a lot, and I tried twice to cover that argument in this class, but failed both this time. So let me not just cover it. So that's it for today. So next time we do theory of transport.